This is Brian Gitt.
My name is Patrick Moore.
This is Dr. William Mackus.
This is Bruce Party.
This is Tom Luongo.
This is Steve Barber, and you're listening to the Sean Newman Podcast.
Welcome to the podcast, folks. Happy Monday. Hope everybody's Thanksgiving weekend has been enjoyable. What a beauty day on Sunday. On this side, we got out, did a little, I don't know, we call it tennis ball, you know, baseball with the tennis ball. I was hoping for a little Blue Jays action on Sunday, and obviously they blew that. So we got outside and played with the kids, threw the ball around a little bit. Always great to spend some time with family and friends. And then, of course, like the day was just like gorgeous. And anytime we get, you know, gorgeous days in October, you got to take them while you can, because we all know winter is around the corner. I hate reminding myself and you that, but coming sooner than later. Either way, it was a great weekend, and I hope you got, wherever you're at, some time to, you know, got to spend some time with family, friends. And, you know, we didn't do Friendsgiving this year. Normally we do. I don't know, was it kids? I was trying to think about it. I have no idea. But at least we got to see some family and get the cousins together and all that good stuff. Now, hopefully, wherever you're at, you enjoyed it as well. We got a good one on tap for you today on your holiday Monday. But before we get there, let's get to today's episode sponsors, Canadians for Truth. They're a nonprofit organization consisting of Canadians who believe in honesty and integrity and principled leadership in government, as well as the Canadian Bill of Rights, Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and the rule of just laws. I was out there in Calgary hosting their Canadians for Media unveil, and if you go to Canadians for Truth on Facebook or to canadiansfortruth.ca, you can see the full event. Man, the video from it was superb. So if you go check out that, you can see what we did there a few weekends ago, and by all means, let me know what you think, and keep following them to see what you know, Theo, Joseph, and Jamie are all up to, as they have unveiled their shows, and they'll be coming here pretty quick, and it'll be interesting to see where they go with it, and I'll be certainly following along. Clay and Smiley and Prophet River, man, I drove by. Clay and Ed, if you're listening to this, you got to let me know. I don't recall seeing the giant Prophet River logo, symbol, name across the building on the one side. Anyways, it's huge. We were driving, and I'm like, has that been there? Is that in there the entire time? I don't know. Either way, they specialize in importing firearms from the United States of America and pride themselves in making this process as easy as possible for all their customers. And all you got to do is go to ProfitRiver.com to find out more. They are the major retailer of firearms, optics, and accessories serving all of Canada. Doesn't matter where you're at, Profit River can help you out. Tracy and Tyson Mitchell with Mitchco Environmental, a family-owned business that has been providing professional vegetation management services for both Alberta and Saskatchewan in the oil field and industrial sectors since 1998. They're always looking for good people. So right now is a bit of the off season, but I would put the note in the back of your brain, because, you know, as the winter months will certainly roll along, it will be no time flat, and they'll be looking for people again. So go to mitchcocorp.ca if you're interested. We had a guy come out, and I'm spacing on your name, but he reached out to sounds like pretty much a ton of the sponsors, which is super cool. Came from Ontario, and it sounds like he's going to hang his hat to the west side of Alberta, which is, well, I can't blame a guy for, he came out to Lloyd and everything and experienced, talked to a bunch of them. Anyways, you get the point. Super cool. So if you're looking for work, there's tons going on here in Alberta. And of course, we got a new premier, was at that event as well with Danielle Smith. And, you know, it went to the sixth ballot and she won with 53%. But interesting days ahead, I think, for Alberta as, you know, we march along to another election in May. But Danielle Smith at the helm for the UCP, so it should be interesting nonetheless. Carly Clausen and the team over at Windsor Plywood, builders of the podcast studio table for everything wood. These are the guys. I had another guy in the studio, a guest, cop coming up soon, and he walked in. He's like, so this is the table, eh? He kind of gave it the old rub, and I'm like, yeah, this is the table. He's like, man, this is solid. Well, whether you're talking about mantels, decks, windows, doors, sheds, or, you know, that table, Windsor Plywood is the team. Give them a call, 780-875-9000. 9663. Gartner Management is a Lloydminster-based company specializing in all types of rental properties to help meet your needs. Whether you're looking for a small office or you got bigger requirements, give Wade a call, 780-808-5025. And before we get to the tail of the tape, I should remind everyone, QDM and Two's stand-up tickets are still on sale. That's November 5th here in Lloydminster at the Gold Horse Casino. Would love to have you guys there. The link is in the show notes. Now, let's get on that tail of the tape brought to you by Hancock Petroleum. For the past 80 years, they've been an industry leader in bulk fuels, lubricants, methanol, and chemicals, delivering to your farm, commercial oil field locations. For more information, visit them at hancockpetroleum.ca. He's the co-founder of Rivero, orthopedic surgeon, world-leading authority on treating disease with medical nutritional therapy, an Amazon best-selling author, world champion athlete, international speaker, podcast host, and consultant. I'm talking about Dr. Sean Baker. So buckle up, because here we go.
This is Sean Baker, and you're listening to the Sean Newman Podcast.
Well, welcome to the Sean Newman Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Sean Baker. So first off, sir, thanks for hopping on.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'll be interested to have a discussion with you and reach out to your audience. So great. Thanks for having me.
Well, and I want to start there. I assume my audience knows exactly who Sean Baker is, but I best not think that. I'd like you to tell them exactly who Sean Baker is. You can go wherever you like with that. And from there, we'll jump off and see where we get to.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm a 55-year-old man. I'm, I got a father of four kids. I trained as an orthopedic surgeon. I was a former military guy, a professional athlete, had world records in a number of different sports over the years. I still am very active as an athlete and have been very interested in the last 10, 15 years as mostly as it impacted my own health initially and eventually got down this crazy sort of path on nutrition, which ended up with me on this all meat diet. And I ended up writing a book about it called The Carnivore Diet, and got a little bit of notoriety when I went on Joe Rogan's podcast, and a lot of people were exposed to either what they thought would made sense or what they see. And I've been pursuing this for the last six and a half years now, and continue to promote meat as a healthy part of the diet, and in some cases a meat-only diet for some people, depending on their medical condition. And we've got a company that we started called Rivero, which we basically take people, we put them on sometimes all-meat diets, sometimes other types of diets, and we basically get them off pills, get them off drugs, reverse their disease, and do what healthcare should be doing in the first place. And, instead we have this system that is bloated, expensive, and not very efficient. So I'm trying to provide an alternative to that. And thus far, we've been doing very well.
I hate to stop right now, but I'm wondering, your internet connection keeps bouncing on me. So I'm wondering, two things. One of the things we've tried in the past is having you go out, come back in. Another thing is, it could be your background, just the extra, trying to have the virtual background. I don't know if you're willing to just, I don't know what you have behind you. And it doesn't matter to me.
Plain old green screen. It doesn't matter to me. I can drop it off.
Otherwise the audio is going to be shit and nobody's going to enjoy that. To the listener, we pause for a second here to just see if we can figure out a couple things on the audio quality. Obviously what we both love about a Zoom call is, well, everybody knows it by now. I mean, geez, we've had 2+ years of Zoom calls everywhere. So, you mentioned a lot there, Sean, and I guess I'm curious about the journey into the carnivore diet. You mentioned a whole lot of things there, doctor, athlete, I think military in there somewhere. And I go, were you always paying attention to your body? Like, was it something you focused on, like what you were putting in since, you're 18 years old, or is this something that's kind of matured over time?
No, I always was cognizant about eating enough protein. I mean, from the age of about 14, when I first started lifting weights, I was, very, very cognizant about eating plenty of protein-based foods. But beyond that, I didn't give much thought to that until about 40-ish, 42-ish, when I started to see I was like every other 42-year-old. Despite training, I was starting to get, you know, things were hurting. I wasn't in shape as I wanted to be. And then I really started to sort of really, really look into nutrition very hard. And so I've always, you know, trained, and I've always been an athlete. So I've always been interested in performance. But, you know, I you know, outside of, you know, not eating pure junk and eating enough protein, I didn't really give that much thought to nutrition. And I think, for the most part, it worked pretty well. I was able to, like I said, win world championships with that sort of attitude. But eventually, and I think probably when I look back at it, probably by my mid-20s, I was probably starting to see signs of chronic health disease starting to appear, you know, now that I objectively look back. But, you know, back then, I was big, I was strong, I was winning sports. You know, it didn't seem to matter then.
What, when you look back, What do you mean? What sticks out to you? What were the early signs to you? And the reason I bring it up is if you're somebody sitting in maybe their 40s or maybe their 30s or maybe their 20s, just, you know, when you're young, you don't think anything. Yeah, you know, I mean, like, geez Louise, you just kind of keep plowing through everything and you never take any notice of anything. And the ones that do are special by all means. But when you look back, what are the ones that stick out to you? Like, what were the chronic, if I go back, I was doing that and I didn't realize what that meant.
Well, I think, you know, one, I mean, I started to see just signs of oxidative stress within my skin. I started losing hair in my 20s. I was not as lean as I probably could have been given all the output I was putting out. I mean, I was training, you know, several hours a day, very effectively. I mean, you know, very strong. I mean, I was, you know, back then I was deadlifting, you know, 350 kilograms as a drug-free athlete. I mean, I was a very strong, fit person, could jump. I mean, I could 360 dunk a basketball at, you know, 260 pounds. I mean, all those things I could do, but I mean, I was seeing, you know, some of these things creeping up, you know, and it's just a very, the problem with chronic disease is very slow. Its onset is very slow. And, you know, it's hard to say when it starts, but there's a point where, you know, maybe recovery wasn't as good. You know, maybe, you know, I can contrast it to where I am today, where I can train extremely hard, you know, put my body through a pretty brutal workout, and I recover better, and I feel better, and I don't get as sore. Whereas back then, I got sore, which, you know, I thought that was just part of the deal. You know, you train hard enough, you're supposed to get sore. You're supposed to be beat up. That's part of being an athlete. That's part of the sacrifice. And while some of that is there, the degree to which I was experiencing it was probably common, but it wasn't probably necessary to that extent. You know, skin issues. I mean, I used to have really horrible acne when I was a kid, you know, and that's probably related to diet. Clearly it is now that I look back in it. Sleep wasn't great, you know, things like that. I remember sitting in class in medical school and falling asleep. I mean, I thought, well, God, the guy's so boring, I'm going to fall asleep. But it was probably due to blood sugar fluctuations and things like that. It wasn't just the guy was particularly boring. It was just, I just couldn't stay awake, you know, in my classes. I ended up graduating with honors because I did well in the class, but I'd have to go home and read the books, you know, so I could really, assimilate what was going on. But I mean, certain times a day, you sit me down and put me in a dark room and, you know, I'm going to fall asleep. And I noticed that. I just remember that I would, you know, it was pretty reliable. I can remember listening to a urology lecture, and I used to sit in the front row because I wanted to participate. And I literally fell asleep, and my head like hit this guy's projector because it was a little embarrassing. But yeah, just stuff like that, you know, that I look back and I say that was probably signs of poor metabolic health.
Yeah. I assume when you look at the American population, I mean, obviously, I won't test you on Canada. When you look at the American population, your fellow countrymen, I mean, I assume you just see, I don't know, tell me what you think. But like when you see people walking around and, you know, like I've been to different countries on the planet, and I can't find a place quite like the United States of America. For where the amount of fast food, junk, just like it's just at your fingertips everywhere, every little town. And that has, I mean, obviously they wouldn't all be there if they weren't making money. So you look at it and go, like, the issue with American health or people's health in general isn't just as simple as, or maybe it is. I have no idea. I guess I come back to with you, when you see that, what do you see?
Well, I mean, it's truly saddening to go out and look at the general populace because, I've been around for 55 years and, you've been looking at people for most of that time. And so you just see this, incredible increase, not only in obesity. I mean, as you probably know, 42% of Americans are obese as of, I think, 2019. It's probably closer to 45% now after this pandemic. 75%, if they're not obese, are overweight. So most people are fat, just to put it mildly. And not only that, but the rest of them appear either frail or what we call skinny fat, where they're just, there's just no visible tone to them at all. Most of them are suffering from some sort of affliction, particularly after you get past age, even 30 now. My gosh, there's 20-year-olds and teenagers that are already morbidly obese and suffering from disease. I think something like 20-25% of our population is currently on some sort of psychiatric medication for depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, or some other issue, And it's just getting worse and worse and worse. And so it literally is kind of depressing to be out in the population, except for the fact that I'm generally pretty happy because I'm not afflicted with that stuff, and I have what I think is a very good diet, and lifestyle overall. You're right. America leads the world in a lot of the stuff, but we're rapidly exporting this. I just got back from the UK, and I certainly saw that. I think they're about 20 years behind us. Probably Canada. I don't know. I'm suspecting something similar where you're starting to see this level of obesity, and it's becoming multi-generational. Now in the United States, we've had fully three generations of seriously obese people, and they just pass it right on to their kids, and it's lifestyle, and it's epigenetic modifications, and it's intrauterine environment, and all these things where you just continue to develop this. And we've gotten to the point where many people have just given up instead of trying to fix this issue. Let's just normalize it and say, okay, everybody's beautiful, and have at it, and just don't worry about it. There's no bad foods. Just keep stuffing your face with donuts. No one should judge you. And those messages are going out there. And I think it's just people that are, they're literally frustrated. They've literally just given up. And so the answer is either I'm, doomed to be sick, or I'm just going to accept it and enjoy it for however long I have on earth, which is, I think, really sad, sad way to go.
Yeah. You enter into what I'm just really complex problem. I think, could be wrong on that. Like, I feel like the easy answer is the toughest one, and people won't like that. And governments, will probably be ousted for it if they just told everybody, like, listen, we got to start taking care of yourself, right? Like, we got to find a way. But it's so intertwined with what's been built in the Western world over, I always joke, like, if I had a time machine, Sean, I'd go back in time to, I think it's 1950 something. Don't quote me on that. To when the colonel is going around with his KFC truck trying to, like, even in Canada, going around Canada trying to pop up these KFCs. And I would have put a stop to it. Because I look at what the fast food industry employs how many people now. It's become this juggernaut. And yet it's almost slowly killing our entire population on the West. And it's led to habit forming things, like you say, generational obesity and things like that. And I don't even know the health ramifications of that. I just look at that and I go, those are things that aren't easily untwined by one simple change. Or maybe you have a different thought.
Well, I think, and I'll just go back to this, the last 2.5 years where we went through this pandemic, and, it's very clear that the people that suffered the most were the people that were, had underlying illnesses, whether they're either it's due to age, but more often it's age plus underlying illnesses, obesity, diabetes, metabolic disease, so on and so forth. And clearly we know that those things are affected by lifestyle modifications. And in many cases, those things are rapidly changed. People can improve their blood sugar, in a week. They can lose weight, significant weight, in a month. And not once, never, by any government agency did even a person say, hey, it would be a good time to drop some of that excess body fat. Even if they disagreed about how to do that, just to let the people know that, hey, if you just do something, I think everybody would agree that, you know, just being more active is beneficial, being less sedentary. I don't think there's any controversy around that to tell people stop sitting around so much and just get outside and, you know, go for a 15-minute walk a couple times a day. That is that's not even controversial. There's no one that would disagree that that is generally a helpful message. And yet none of that was shared. Now, the underlying issue, you know, really, I mean, it's very complicated because there's so much money and conflict of interest, you know, built up into this stuff. You know, how much money is made on healthcare? How much, you know, in the U.S., it was $3.5 trillion a few years ago. I'm sure it's, you know, significantly more than that now. How much money is made by, you know, our agricultural system, which is based, you know, our USDA, you know, promotes wheat and corn and soy and sugar. I mean, this is what they do, and yet they also write our food guidelines. And so look at the conflict of interest there. They want to have us maximize produce wheat, corn, sugar, and soy production, and yet write the dietary guidelines. And then when you look at all the ingredients that wheat, corn, sugar, and soy make, it's basically just processed food, which is, you know, ultimately ends up being horrible for us. I think, you know, if you were to tell people, hey, just stop eating stuff that's in a box that's hyper-processed, ultra-processed. I know there's controversy about what does processing mean, but, you know, when you pick up a package and it's got, you know, 27 ingredients in there, and most of them aren't food, most of them are thickeners and stabilizers and flavors and, you know, whatever, preservatives, so they can be on the shelf for 6 years, that's not good for us to eat. And so if you just reduce that from your diet, that's going to have a huge impact. But what is the financial impact to the economy? It's huge. I mean, you know, can you imagine if all these shops that, you know, make their business, you know, selling this stuff, you know, had to shut, close up their doors? You know, if we were to suddenly start getting all these people healthy, you know, the healthcare sector would dramatically drop. What about all these employees, all these healthcare employees, all the doctors and nurses and nurses aides and radiology techs and lab techs and, you know, on and on. Again, this is a trillion-dollar industry that we're talking about here. So you're taking that out. You're taking a lot of the food stuff out. A lot of the restaurants that sell basically kind of crappy food would be, you know, out of business. And so that's a huge hit to the economy. So does anybody want to do that? Does anybody want to have the appetite to do that? I don't think so. And, you know, you mentioned the fast food places, which, yeah, absolutely. This idea of I can get a meal in under 5 minutes. That's great. You know, it's very convenient, so you can do other things in life, but what does that ultimately do to us? And yeah, I mean, I think if when I look at the nutritional guidelines, the country of Brazil came out with guidelines a few years ago, quote unquote, call them guidelines, or more just how to eat. And they basically said, eat at home, cook meals, use whole, you know, unprocessed ingredients, and eat with people you love. And that's their guidelines, you know, and not that Brazil is the healthiest place in the world, but I mean, that sort of guideline of people would follow that would really have much better impact than, you know, what we see now, which is don't eat saturated fat, don't eat this, don't eat that, eat this amount of this and this amount of that, all of which is controversial. Much of it is argued is not even evidence-based, or at least not based on current science. And, you know, it really doesn't serve the purpose of getting people to what it should be is eating at home, eating whole foods, cooking your own food. You know, if you do that, that solves a huge number of these problems.
If you're listening to this, and let's say you've been struggling with your weight or even medications and stuff like that, because I've always argued in my brain with myself and with others, if I start to have an issue, the first thing I do is I'm like, okay, what have I been doing lately? Instead of what can I take to help fix this, if that makes sense. And certainly sometimes that's changing diet. Certainly that's vitamins and different things like that. But let's say you're sitting here, you're listening to the two Sean's go back and forth, and you're going, okay, what are some steps I can take? I know I've been indulging a little too much. Maybe I'm not going to the gym, et cetera. How do I break out of where I'm at? What are some simple things that Mr. Baker thinks?
Well, I mean, I can tell you what I advocate. I think, you know, you go on a meat-based diet, and that largely, it addresses a number of issues. One, it's the nutrition is just far superior. I know people say, well, plant, you know, vegetables and fruits have all these antioxidants and polyphenols and phytonutrients. I will just tell you that, you know, the reality is meat is a better source of nutrition by far. It's more bioavailable. It supports what we need as humans with animal cells and animal tissues. That's what we need to consume. It sounds simplistic, but it actually works in practice. It very much helps with cravings and providing you actual satiety. Most people, you know, you eat and you don't get much nutrition, and you continue to be hungry, and you continue to eat, and you continue to think about food, and you continue to prepare about food, and you continue to, you know, it's a constant feeding fest for most people. It's either all day long thinking about food, or actually eating the food or preparing the food. And, you know, we get up at, you know, whatever, 6 a.m., 7 a.m., and we start eating. We don't stop eating until we go to bed, you know, 9 or 10 p.m. Whereas, you know, contrast to what I do once or twice a day, you know, it takes me literally 5 or 10 minutes to prepare my meals and about that much time to eat them, and I'm done. And so I've got all this time to do all these other things. Well, meanwhile, I'm completely, you know, nourished, and I'm able to, you know, train, work out, you know, do whatever I'm doing work-wise, family-wise, you know, enjoy things. I'm not obsessing about food. I enjoy what I eat, you know, without even, you know, not exaggerating at all. I mean, I had 2 New York strips and, you know, 8 eggs for breakfast. Completely enjoyed every bit of that, you know, and it's something that I find is very easy to do. Most people will, you know, what about this? What about heart disease? What about gout? What about fiber? You know, what about vitamin C? All these things that will be questioned, I can, you know, I mean, the short answer is most of that is not really a concern if you really want to look into it. And the long answers are very long answers. They're podcast length answers to go into that stuff and do it real service. But, you know, I mean, I think, you know, cutting out the hyper-processed, you know, very palatable. Many times, of course, it's very palatable. I had a lady who was a chemical engineer with one of these food companies, and she said, hey, I want to come work for you guys because I've been doing this for 20-some years, and my job has been to make processed food addictive. And I no longer can ethically live with myself because of how many people I know that ultimately have been hurt by this. And so, you know, just, you know, I mean, just have to make it a commitment that if you're really serious about this, you know, it can't be a, you know, I'm going to go on a crash diet and drop 20 pounds, you know, over the next month. Great. That's fine. But, you know, 2 months later, you're going to be back on the same garbage. So you just have to be willing to make this a lifelong, you know, change of philosophy, I suppose. And, you know, what do you value? And as the older I get, you know, the less some of these things that were important to me when I was 20 and 30 become. And it's more, you value your time, you value your health, you value experiences. And when you are chronically sick due to a bad lifestyle and much of it being diet, then, hey, life's not that fun. And, you know, it's kind of like, I mean, I can't tell you how many patients I used to take care of. And I mean, they were in their 40s and 50s. And I mean, they were effectively dead at that point. I mean, they had nothing to look forward to. They were in chronic pain. Their schedule was based on a doctor, you know, and that was it. And that's no quality of life as far as I'm concerned.
Well, take me back then to you starting to dabble with the carnivore diet, because I'm curious. To me, it just seems, certainly it's like, Joe has had yourself on and others to talk about the carnivore diet. Carnivore diet has become, where you walk around and even here, I can bring it up and people are, oh yeah, 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 yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? And I'm like, it is interesting, but it is still, to this point, I don't know. I guess the word that pops to my brain, Sean, is extreme, I guess is the way that I would, and I don't know if that's the proper one, but that's what jumps to my brain. So take me back through your steps of how you get introduced. Like, did you ever think of going, maybe I should just stick to plants? Maybe I should just try that style? Because there's been an awful lot written about it.
So I never went, you know, vegan or vegetarian. I just never did that. But I went to a point like, so, you know, I'm 42 years old. I'm 290 pounds. I'm sleep apnea, you know, mildly hypertensive, probably pre-diabetic, you know, blood pressure slightly elevated. I'm walking around. I'm a surgeon. I'm like, this is bullshit. So I said, I'm going to go on a diet. And so I go on this, you know, I ramp up my activity to where I'm getting up at 5 a.m. and doing 3,000 jump ropes. And on my lunch hours, you know, between clinic, I go get a workout in. Then I get home, put my kids to sleep, do another 3,000 jump ropes. I drop my caloric intake from, you know, whatever I was eating back then to about half that. And it's mostly plants, you know, a lot of leafy green vegetables, a lot of fiber, beans, and a little bit of protein, a little bit of chicken and fish. And I successfully drop, you know, 50 pounds in 3 months. I get lean. And I am the most miserable son of a bitch on the planet because I'm hungry, I'm tired, I'm cold. The nurses are like, God, we like that fat Dr. Baker a hell of a lot better because you're kind of an asshole. And it's because I was, you know, I was just damn pissed off all the time. I didn't have enough food. And I mean, people say, well, that's extreme. And that is extreme. And it certainly wasn't sustainable for me. But then I was like, well, I can't do this for the rest of my life. There's no way. And I didn't like it. I mean, I didn't like what I was eating. I was literally freaking eating, you know, leaves all day long. And it's like, this sucks. So then I, you know, then I'd start looking at, well, then paleo was popular back then. I said, well, let me try this paleo thing. And I, you know, started looking and making all these paleo recipes. And honestly, I thought, well, it tastes a hell of a lot better. I enjoyed it a little more and was able to maintain my body weight. And then, I started to read about nutrition, you know, this is back, you know, what year was that? Probably 2010, something like that. And, you know, I started really looking at it and started, you know, kind of looking at some of this low carb literature and, started to kind of just question my preconceived beliefs about nutrition, which weren't very strongly held anyway. I just kind of had this general fruits and vegetables are good for you and too much fat's bad for you and sugary stuff and junk food's bad for you. And don't eat cookies and milk, cookies and, you know, ice cream all the time, which most people understand. I mean, most people would fall into that category. And a balanced diet. That balanced diet was important in this and that. And then as I got into low carb, I started doing that. And finally I went on a ketogenic diet and that was just, it was weird for me because the first time in my life, I wasn't hungry. You know, I was just like, well, maybe I'm burning my own body fat or something, but I'm not actually hungry for the first time in my life. I could skip lunch. I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. I never been able to do that before. So that there was something, a physiological shift that occurred to me. And at this point I was, you know, I had a lot of patients, had a lot of fat patients that needed knee replacements and hip replacements. And truth be told, it kind of sucks operating on fat people. And they're harder to operate on. There's more blood loss. There's more risk for infection. They have higher rates of blood clots. The exposure is more difficult. You know, it's they don't do as well generally. Although they generally, you know, mostly they do pretty good. But in general, it's just not as fun. And so we, as a collective community of orthopedic surgeons, said, hey, we don't like the higher risk and complication rates in these obese patients. And so we are going to, as a collective community, say we're not operating over people over a certain BMI. 35 was a cutoff. And that's, you know, a lot of people come in, you know, BMI above 35 wanting joint replacements. So you would explain to them, said, hey, Mrs. Jones, hey, yes, you need a knee replacement, but unfortunately you're 30 pounds too heavy. Let's get some of that weight off you. And so I'd send them, you know, tell them that, try to tell them, hey, lose weight, exercise more, you know, eat less calories. And, you know, they'd come back in, you know, 2-3 weeks and they'd lost 5 pounds. I said, good job, keep going. And they'd come back for the next visit and they'd gain it all back. And now they're crying in the office and saying, oh, they're never going to lose weight and they're in horrible pain. And then you just write in a chart, okay, patient unsuccessfully tried to lose weight, lost. We're going to get a waiver and we're going to do the joint replacement anyway. And we did that. And then some people went to, you know, weight loss, to bariatric surgeons to have their anatomy, you know, reorganized or dissected and resected. And then I started putting people on this ketogenic diet as I did that. And I started to see something really unusual. I saw not only were people losing weight, you know, the ones that would do it, not everybody would do it. You know, probably less than a half the people, maybe a third of the people would actually try it. But some of the people would come back, you know, very early, 2 weeks in, maybe lost a couple pounds, not much, but they profoundly noted that their joint pain was gone. You know, somebody that I literally was going to schedule for surgery because they were in such severe pain and they had a radiographic findings consistent with it. And they would say, hey, you know, doc, my knee doesn't really hurt anymore. I'm like, well, hell, there's no point in doing surgery at that point. And so that got me really, really sort of, that really sort of piqued my interest and I really started digging into some of this stuff. And then eventually I found these crazy people doing an all-meat diet. They called them zero-carb diet. And there was a group called Zeroing In on Health, actually on Facebook. And I was just reading this stuff, and I was fascinated. I thought, this sounds like the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. It sounds crazy. But shit, these people are getting healthy. What's going on here? And then I started, you know, looking at it, and I said, well, you know, it's very plausible in the rest of the world, or even today, an almond diet is kind of the norm. You know, if you go up circumpolar, you know, regions, you know, some of the, you know, First Nations people in Canada, particularly the Inuit up there in Nunavut and stuff like that, that's kind of what they're eating, you know, and they weren't obese, certainly, and they didn't have the chronic disease that we have today. You know, the one criticism with the Inuit is, you know, they had some level of heart disease on some mummies they found, but you realize that they smoke at these ridiculously high rates, something like 75% of these folks, they smoke, and they start smoking about age of 8. So there's this little confounding factor there. But so I then after following these people and reading about it and looking at the plausibility, look at some of the old athletes that used to do it, and I was an athlete still interested in performance, I said, well, let me just try for a day. Let's go steak and eggs for a day. And I did it, and I was like, hey, it's not bad. Hey, I liked it. I enjoyed the food. I like steak and eggs anyway. And I really didn't miss the toast, and I didn't miss the green stuff. And I was like, okay, well, I could do this. And then I said, well, the next time I was like, I'm going to do it for 3 days. And then I did it for a week, and then I did it for 2 weeks. And then finally in 2016, I did it for a straight month. And, you know, I was on social media, and I was kidding around. I said, hey, guys, I'm going to do this crazy all-meat diet for a month. I know I'm going to die. What do you think I'm going to – I took a poll. What do you think I'm going to die? Am I going to die scurvy? Is my heart going to seize up and stop from all the cholesterol? Is my colon going to fall out from lack of fiber, as a joke, you know, and we had a good laugh at that. And, you know, of course, none of those things happened. In fact, the only thing that happened to me is like, I felt friggin' fantastic. I was like, this is the best I've literally felt in 2 decades. I mean, chronic pain in my leg. I used to have this tendonitis in my right quadriceps. You know, I remember I was squatting 500 pounds one time, felt something pop, and I think I partially tore my quad tendon. And that just bothered me for literally, you know, years and years, and it would come and go, and it would be, but it was always there mildly, and sometimes it'd be pretty severe, and so to the point where it was hard to walk. And that just went away. 2 months in, I was like, this stuff is gone. And I was like, just amazed. I mean, I did it for 1 month, and I stopped, and I said, well, that was a cool 1 month experiment, and went back to my more balanced diet, and I immediately started feeling bad. Immediately, my gut started hurting, everything started getting inflamed. I was like, I don't really like, I much like feeling better the way I was feeling when I was on this all meat diet. So I just hopped right back on it. It was doing it about a year, and then Joe Rogan, you know, I guess caught wind of it, invited me on the show to chat about it. And that inspired Michaela Peterson to do it, and then her father did it, and then all these other people started doing it. And I've been doing it now for, you know, six years, and I literally continue to feel great. And, you know, I'm trying to get the message out there that, you know, as a middle-aged male, you know, like I said, I'm 55, you don't have to be fat and have that big beer belly or that big gut and have pain and back pain and depression and poor energy and all those types of things. Those are all, they're very normal. I mean, they're very common, but they're not normal. And we just see it over and over again. You know, most guys are like, oh, you know, I'm over 30, and they're ready to hang up their cleats. I'm like, you got to be kidding me, man. You're not even halfway through life yet, and you're hanging it up. So that's what I found. I just find that I think when we have a good diet stream, right, and it is. I mean, it certainly is. It's very restrictive in ways. It's very liberating others. I've had so many people tell me that it's liberating not to be, morbidly depressed, or, you know, have chronic pain or have some autoimmune disease or some horrible gut issue where I have to go to the bathroom 20 times a day and I'm bleeding out my, you know, my rear end. Those things are very restrictive. And when you're saying I'm free from all that, I literally, for the first time in my life, my brain is clear. I don't hurt all the time. I actually can, you know, live a lot. That becomes very liberating for people. So I think there's, you know, this sort of interesting thing where if you decide, hey, that other garbage out there is not for me, you know, and most of it, you know, like I said, I don't blame necessarily people eating bananas for all their illnesses, but, you know, there's very few people that eat just whole food. I mean, there's some people that will claim they're on a whole food vegan diet, and I can talk about the problems with that particular strategy, but, you know, I think, you know, once you've kind of fixed everything, and I see so many people do it, they spend 3 months, 6 months, a year doing, you know, an all-meat diet, and then they are able to, you know, add back in a few things. They add back in a few whole fruits and vegetables or rice or something like that, and then that becomes their diet, and they become very happy with that.
I think it's a really cool story because very few people, and I shouldn't say that. It took me until being 32, 33, somewhere in there, where I actually started paying attention to my brother, my body. My brother had colitis when he was 18 and so had one of his intestines removed. I remember having a health issue and asking him about it. And he said, well, you just got to start paying attention to what you're eating, you know, see what happens when you eat certain things. And if there's, you know, kind of a repercussion from doing said thing. And by no means am I perfect. And when I listen to yours, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Like you've really paid attention to your body for a long time. But I think for a lot of people, they don't understand that you can't have pain. So it's just the way their body is, right? It's just kind of sore. You mentioned gut, didn't like that feeling, depression, tired, poor sleep, all these things for a lot of people are probably just life. And it's really cool to hear you talk about it because it's kind of like once you realize if I do something, oh man, it's like, I love how it's that immediate. I look for things that are that immediate. Do you eat honey at all? Just a random side note.
I do not. Yeah. I mean, I know there's some people that advocate honey and fruit and all this stuff. You know, I just don't feel as good that when I do that.
Oh, so
I do what works for me and, you know, more power for people that do that and they do fine, but I don't.
The reason I bring it up, Sean, is one of the first things I was having a poor sleep and I wasn't sleeping that well. And I took some honey from just like whole honey from a farm and put it in my tea. And you know, at the time I thought it was a really, really stupid idea. I'm like, I'm literally giving myself sugar before bed. This is a terrible idea. And it knocked me out two nights in a row, like drooling on myself. And I don't, you know, you're the doc. I don't fully understand everything. All I know is when you talk to old timers from the area, they talk about the healing powers of honey and different things, remedies that back in the day they used to do, not only with the humans, but their livestock and everything else. And so ever since I experienced that, I'm like, what else don't I know about food that they're not telling me and, or that we've just forgotten?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot, obviously we've forgotten this because we're not exposed to that. I mean, I think, you know, unfortunately we go another generation into and people forget what even being healthy even means because no one will actually have experienced it. But, you know, I mean, when you look at the data on sleep and food, yes, there's data that shows that for some people, carbohydrates at night are actually beneficial for sleep. There's other studies that show it's not. And it's very, you know, it's kind of all over the place there. But, you know, like I said, I always tell people if something's clearly working for you, then by all means, you know, if there's no significant downside to it, you know, good night's sleep is tremendous medicine. I mean, that is, you know, there's so many people that don't get good sleep and that has a huge impact on so many different health variables. So if, you know, a teaspoon of honey before you go to bed helps you sleep, then I'd be like, great, go do that. I don't have, you know, personally, I don't have problems sleeping. Food does, if it does impact my sleep, and I know if I eat really late at night, for instance, and I eat a big giant protein meal before night, I'm not going to sleep as well. And there's, you know, clear physiology why that occurs. But so, I mean, you know, I do it for me that works well, but yeah, that's an important thing. If that little hack helps you, by all means do it.
Well, and I should point out, it was the first hack that I found that led me down, trying different things. Cause I definitely don't have honey before I don't need the honey anymore. Like I sleep really well, but it was the first thing that it was so evident that it was like, wow, I didn't think I could do that. I didn't think I could have an immediate impact, you know, and just like boom. And there it is. And so I bring it up because I think a lot of people don't pay attention to their body. And to hear your story, I hope a lot of people hear that and go, huh, you could literally tonight try different things that you think are a little bit outside the box. And have immediate impacts on your body. And it's not that hard. You can literally monitor it because it's you.
Yeah. I mean, the one of the things that I think really is sort of interesting is, you know, if we look at like our digestive system, for instance, you know, many of us, you know, we're used to belching and bloating and farting and having to, you know, bloat, you know, discomfort. That's kind of normal. Most people have experienced that, you know, if not on a daily basis, on a fairly regular basis. And I would argue that most of that is abnormal. That's not supposed to happen. And the reason it happens is either one of two things. Either there's something wrong with your digestive system. There's a pathology going on, or you're just sticking the wrong food in there. And so if those things are happening, because if I walk, up and down the stairs and my knees are hurting, I'm going to say, hell, there's something wrong with my knee. That's not supposed to be happening. Or if I go for a run and all of a sudden my lungs are really hurting, I'm going to say there's something wrong with my lungs. Or if I have chest pain when I exert myself, all of us would agree there's something wrong. Like a headache, we're saying something is wrong. But we seem to accept this discomfort and pain and bloating and with our digestive tract and just chalk it up to, well, that's kind of normal. I will tell you it's not. Because, I had 2.5 pounds of steak and 8 eggs for breakfast. I mean, I could have went out and ran 10 miles afterwards. I mean, I just have no perception of any discomfort at all while digesting food. And I think that's how we're designed. And it's something that, it's an immediate feedback. And so if you're like, hey, every time I, this is kind of a really goofy thing. It's a silly observation I've noticed. Since I've been on this diet, I haven't hiccuped in 6 years. Most of us, we get it every once in a while. We're like, well, it's because we have diaphragmatic irritation.
And Sean, you cut out on me for a quick sec. Did you say hiccup?
Yeah. Hiccup. Yeah. I haven't hiccuped in 6 years. And I'm just thinking, like, that's interesting. It's not anything. No one really care about that. We're like, okay, you didn't hiccup. Who cares? But why are we hiccuping in the first place? What? There's something wrong. It's like, your computer's rebooting or something like that. Well, I mean, it's, the physiology is, some people think it's diaphragmatic irritation. And so, well, why isn't my diaphragm being irritated anymore? What was irritating it in the first place? So it's something probably nutritionally speaking. And there's other things you see. It's like, I really itch. You're scratching yourself, from time. I rarely have that occur. It's just like all these sort of normal sort of things you just notice as your existence go away. It's like, well, that was weird. I just never do that anymore. And does nutrition have a role there? Well, it seems to, at least in my view. And many other people have noticed this observation as well.
That's cool. As a guy who's certainly, I've never tried the carnivore diet. I listen to you and I'm like, that sounds interesting. And you're making my brain churn on it. I'm watching the clock here as it rolls along. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about was, when I first reached out, it was when Health Canada was going to put warning labels on ground beef here in Canada. And I thought, I come from an agricultural background. I come from an agricultural part of the world. And I'm like, this seems strange. And I was curious, your thoughts on it. There's all these, whether we're talking Beyond Meat, and I was chuckling. I was actually just talking to my brothers about that. It went from a high of $178 a share. And as of today, a year later, it's at $15 a share, right? Like, you can see the push for that, the push for all these things that aren't what they are. And then, to have Health Canada come out and say, we're going to put warning labels on ground beef. What are your thoughts on that? Like, is that an active direct attack on meat in general? Because I know it's been linked. They try and link it to climate change and everything else as well.
Yeah, I mean, there is a narrative there. There is a clear agenda to sort of shift you onto a more centralized food supply and processed food supply for simple, I think it has to do with greed, quite honestly. And I mean, the purpose of a warning label is, this is a product that has a higher amount of saturated fat, and therefore it's going to increase your risk for heart disease. The problem with that is that's not conclusively been shown. In fact, there was a nice study in European Journal of Preventive Cardiology just came out a few weeks ago. Saturated fat has nothing to do with heart disease. All the randomized control trials and all the, the synthesis of all the data doesn't seem to suggest that. And moreover, if we look at, for instance, the United States stat, which we mentioned is just absolutely horrible, the majority of the saturated fat that is in my diet, or not my diet, but my country's, it's coming from desserts and, processed food and chips and cookies and crackers and snack foods. That's where most of the saturated fat that Americans get. And the question is it the saturated fat, or is it the fact that it's in a lot of junk food? That's a problem. And so instead of saying you should eliminate beef because it has saturated fat, why don't you just say you should eliminate all this processed garbage? That would do far better You know, there's no warning label on, is there a warning label on, a can of Coca-Cola? I mean, is that on there? I haven't seen that. I don't think it is. That would be more apt to actually have an impact. Yeah, there is kind of a war on meat, so to speak, it's the health argument. I think most people, when you look at it, it's very nebulous as to whether it's good or bad. I obviously believe it's a very good food, and I think the data actually supports that when you really dig into it. But and it's something that you can test yourself. Like I said, go on a steak and eggs diet for 3 months and see what happens to your body. I mean, unequivocally, most people will notice they just get tremendously healthier. So if that's true and that occurs more often than not, then how do you make meat a bad food for you when people are getting healthier? I have people that are literally getting off lifelong medications just by eating steak. And it's like, well, how is that a damaging food when you're actually literally curing diseases? But so then they go after the climate angle. It's a climate change. So they're losing the health battle. So now they're going to switch to the climate battle. And, the climate stuff is also, it's nonsense to think that cows in a field are driving climate change. If you want to point to, an anthropogenic, problem, you're going to be looking at, gas plants and coal mines and all the fossil fuel industry and all the transportation and all that stuff. But they continue to try to scapegoat, meat eating because, there's money to be made in some of this other stuff, and we're seeing that repeated. And it's, again, the data on this stuff is pretty clear that animal agriculture has an impact on the environment for sure. But in the United States, for instance, if we look at it, the EPA data clearly states that 5% of our greenhouse gases come from plant agriculture and 4% come from animal agriculture. So why are we trying to get rid of animal agriculture when you can't even have plant agriculture without animal agriculture? Does it make sense to continue to make it more efficient and more sustainable? Arguably, yes. I mean, I think there's some good and some silliness that's coming out there. Having cows walking around with masks on and having the population eating crickets, as you guys have in, I can't remember which province is the big cricket province, but
Ontario.
Ontario is just stupid. I mean, it's literally stupidity.
Well, it just, I look at this and I go, it just seems like another agenda where no matter what one side is saying, they're just pushed down and they're given zero voice. And it just keeps happening. Well, to me, where I sit, because I get to talk to all these different wonderful people talking about different things that seem to be working in their given field. And certainly today we're talking meat and food, but like it goes into different, there's a narrative. This is what we want you to say. And we don't want to talk about anything else. And maybe that's follow the money. Maybe that's something a little more nefarious, or maybe that's just as simple as follow the money and you understand what's going on.
I think a lot of it's follow the money for sure. I mean, obviously there's people who are worried about the World Economic Forum and this giant global communist takeover. And we're all going to be eating bugs and strapped into have computer chips in our brains and, on this central bank, digital currency, and every move's going to be tracked in this biosecurity state. I mean, how much of that is realistically going to happen versus not? I don't know. I mean, I think there's some people that would love to see that, quite honestly. Is that significantly really likely to happen? I don't know. I mean, I think it could. I'm kind of optimistic to think that there'll be enough people with enough common sense. And we're seeing some of the pushback, and some of the recent elections, Italy, Sweden, some of these other countries are saying, no.
Hungary.
We're going hungry. I know you've just promoted, I mean, one of the, I can't remember the name, Pierre
Poilievre.
Yeah, he is now a Conservative Party candidate, head, and maybe you'll have a, I don't know how the Canadian election system goes. If there's a lack of confidence, they switch parties, or if it's on a scheduled time, I'm not sure. But it seems like there's a shift back, and maybe common sense is prevailing, and maybe these people that just wanted to, hey, let me just go, raise my cattle out in my ranch and leave me alone. And they're starting to wake up and say, hey, maybe they're not going to leave you alone. Maybe you need to stand up for yourself.
I think on a lot of issues, a lot of those people are waking up and realizing if you don't, there's a lot of people who just want to be left alone. Just let me do my thing. I'm not hurting anybody. I'm paying my taxes. I'm, you know, contributing to society as a whole. And that's not good enough right now. And it seems like it continues to spiral. And I would say a lot of fronts are being hit. And maybe they've always been being hit. That could very well be the case. Bringing it back to health and everything else, do you think there's signs or hope maybe for your fellow countrymen that it can, you know, buck the trend and go the opposite way? You know, there's a lot of people wanting to do something with their body, with their mindset, with everything. I mean, like it's a huge industry in itself, coaching and trying to help people move through, you know, you mentioned right off the hop, a lady, who literally made food addictive. I mean, geez, you're fighting something that's made to make you want to have it. So, do you think there's hope on the horizon of more people going that way and maybe setting a new trend of, I don't know, when the next pandemic comes around, we keep gyms open, we tell people to maybe shed a few pounds, we let people outdoors, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, it's interesting because we see a definite, almost a politicization of nutrition now. You know, we've seen it through all these different issues. And so one of the nice things is, you know, the number of people that maybe didn't care about nutrition before, they were just, you know, and this is how it's come down as a conservative and a liberal side of this things. And, you know, as much as I hate to see it, I think everybody should have access to good nutrition. It should be important. But we're seeing that people that were before really didn't care about nutrition, now they actually care about it because it's become politicized. And so they're standing up and maybe they're going to say, well, guess what? I'm going to start taking care of my health and I'm going to start eating, you know, I'm not going to eat the soybeans and the crickets. I'm going to eat a steak. And I think that's, you know, eventually that's going to bring more attention to this. And perhaps as enough people that there's a threshold amount of the population that sees the nonsense that's occurred. I mean, I think, you know, just as we've been maybe misled about a lot of issues, we've been misled on nutrition too. I mean, I think it's pretty clear. I mean, the same motivations you see these big drug companies have made literally tens of billions of dollars on the back of a lot of people's misery on the back of a pandemic, and they're not ethical. I mean, it's clear these companies are not very ethical. These same things are happening in nutrition, and you know, it's the same thing. It's just, you know, how gullible we are. And when we really, you know, pull back the shades and see the emperor has no clothes on, a lot of people are waking up and they're like, wait a minute, you know. I mean, I think the healthcare system, there's a lot of corruption within the healthcare system. I mean, that's clear as well. And you know, it's you know, inextricably intertwined with the pharmaceutical industry, which is very corrupt in many cases. And so as people see this and they start to wake up, you know, again, it's how many people do that. Now you've got a lot of people that don't think about this stuff. And, you know, if it tastes good and it's cheap and I'm marketed to appropriately, I'm just going to continue to consume this stuff. But I think we're seeing more and more people, you know, sort of realizing this. And I think, you know, once you get to this certain critical threshold mass, you know, it's going to become obvious to the rest of the people. It becomes so obvious that, hey, there's something wrong going on here, and how do we fix it?
Well, before I let you out of here, I'll slide into the final question brought to you by Crude Master Transport. Shout out to Heath and Tracy McDonald, supporters of the podcast since the very beginning. Using Heath's words, he said, if you're going to stand behind something, then stand behind it. What's one thing Sean stands behind?
Well, I think that, you know, I think you should be, I don't think you should outsource, you know, important aspects of your life to other people. I think you should, you know, like your health is one thing. I don't think, you know, expecting your physician or healthcare provider, whoever it is, to take care of that for you makes sense at all. I think you've got to take things under your own hand. You know, if it, you know, use instinct and common sense. I know that is something that sometimes seems controversial when people are telling you stuff that's obviously wrong and they want you to go in there and believe this. And you're like, that's clearly not, stick to your, you know, you stick to what reality tells you and not be, you know, led by, you know, like these people that want to, you know, sell you something or convince you of something or, you know, have you believe, you know, it's like two and two plus two is four. And when people start telling you two plus two is five, continue to tell them they're crazy because they are.
Well, I appreciate you giving me some time today. And, you know, one day I would love to do it in person because, you know, seeing Well, you know this as good as anyone. Being in person and doing these things across from one another is just so much better. But the day that happens will be a treat, I'm sure. Either way, I appreciate you giving me some time today and responding to my, I probably hassled you just as much as the next podcaster, but I sent an artillery of emails your way and messages, and I appreciate you responding and giving me some of your time.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for being patient. And as you mentioned, I'm often running around pretty busy, but I appreciate it. Thanks. And I'd love to meet with you in person sometime when I want to go to Canada. So I know they've restricted who can come in for a while. Maybe they'll open up eventually and we'll see if it becomes a little more freer over there, hopefully.
I think that goes both ways in both of our countries. The United States isn't exactly the easiest place for Canadians to get into right now. But either way, thanks, Sean.
Sean, appreciate it. Thank you very much.